Word of mouth.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Jamaican team came in last in the two-men bobsled events in Sochi, but true to the spirit of the 1994 film Cool Runnings, Jamaican fans sent the team off with a song written to sync with the twists and turns of the 1,500-meter track.
To the left, it's bobsled time. On this freezing night, watch Jamaica slide by.
To the right.
The gold for the two-man bobsled went to Russia. The U.S. took the bronze, the first two-man bobsledding medal for the U.S. in 62 years, which may have something to do with a new high-tech bobsled designed by BMW. Yes, that BMW, the precision luxury German automaker. Michael Scully is creative director at BMW Designworks USA and was an integral part of building a better bobsled. He's also a New Hampshire native who got his winter sport legs on this state's icy mountains. We got to talk with him just before he left for Sochi to see how his rig rides, and I asked him what he was doing before he started working on bobsleds.
I guess over the years, maybe two notable projects that have sort of found the light of day are in 2002, I worked on a Formula BMW race car, which was a carbon fiber monocoque chassis development series car. And then in 2004, I worked on a BMW H2R, which was a hydrogen-powered world speed record car. And we set 9 world speed records with that car.
Well, we've all driven cars. I'm wondering what kind of research goes into designing a bobsled. Did you have to pilot one yourself?
Well, my research was, I would say, firsthand. I actually flew out to the team trials in Lake Placid back in 2011. And, you know, I literally set foot on the ground out by opening the door of my rental car, shook maybe one or two hands, and was put straight into the bobsled at the top of the run. And luckily I didn't have the requirement to drive it. I was a passenger, and Steve Holcomb was driving, and Kurt Tomaszewicz was right behind me. They were both gold medal winning athletes, and so I knew I was in good hands, but I have to say that I thought I was somewhat prepared for that because I had this experience with alpine sports in the past, and you know, I raced cars extensively, so I maybe a little bit of hubris on my side going in, and that was quickly destroyed. It is the most profoundly violent, chaotic, brutal experience I've had, and it actually did inform the design process, and there were a lot of takeaways for me.
Like what? What did you think? You know, when you were going along on this ride, you thought, "Oh, I can make this go even faster."
Well, that sort of level of chaos again. I think it's something if you can help quell that a little bit. You know, just to allow the pilot to focus, or for example, the brakeman, who's the athlete in the back of the sled, for them to brace themselves even a little bit more effectively. I mean, I was clamoring all over the place for anything and everything to hang on to or put my head. And I mean, it was just it really was a nightmare in a way. And I saw that again as an opportunity to try to build in a little bit more functionality on the inside of the sled, and so we've placed a large emphasis on that.
What did the previous bobsled model look like? Very similar?
I would say by comparison, our sled is noticeably smaller. That's probably the first takeaway that somebody would have looking at it. And you know, the real motivation behind that was sort of a double-edged reason. One was aerodynamic, trying to reduce the frontal area, which is really the silhouette that would be cast on a wall if you were to put a spotlight directly in front of the sled. That has a large impact on the aerodynamic properties. But also embracing the physics, the reality of the physics of a bobsled run, which is that this sled is almost never going straight, and it's almost constantly transitioning between corners or in a corner or descending a corner or ascending a corner. And all these movements are things which potentially can slow it down.
in your clamoring around, looking for something to hold on to, I'm wondering what the others were doing. What does one do when inside of a bobsled, just holding on for dear life and praying?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the athletes that do it for real, they hold a very precise position of their body because the profile of, say, for example, the athletes at the back of the sled, that has a huge impact on the aerodynamic performance of the sled. So it's not just the shape of the exterior of the sled that impacts the aerodynamics. It's how the athletes also are involved. And so the contour of their back is something that's important to keep in a certain position. And so they will be sort of bracing themselves pretty much as low as they possibly can get. And, you know, that's obviously not a fun position to experience 5 G's of force at, but that is what they do. And I think, you know, my experience on the track really just gave me an appreciation for that level of force. And it is an extreme sport in a very real way.
Well, we're getting a wild ride inside a bobsled with Michael Scully. He's creative director at BMW Design Works USA, and he designed the two-man bobsled for the U.S. Olympic team. Speaking of that force, top speeds reaching 100 miles an hour. I'm reading a lot of different numbers. How fast do they go?
Yeah, I think, you know, for example, on the Sochi track, which is a very technical track, top speed is not a really incredible number. It's somewhere between 75 and 85 miles an hour is probably realistic. That's still extremely fast on a gravity-propelled object. And, you know, every efficiency at that point is necessary. And so that's really what this project has emphasized is, you know, there is no sort of magic bean that just makes the sled go faster. It's kind of this culmination of hundreds and hundreds of little elements that add up into little nuanced changes that potentially eke out, you know, a little bit of time here, a little bit of time there, and it may add up into a hundredth of a second or a tenth of a second or something like that. But it is a sport of hundredths of a second, so that's sort of the minutia that we try to work in.
Well, with that kind of specifics, I'm wondering, there must be a lot of secrecy around the design. I mean, if any little tweak can get an advantage of even a hundredth of a second.
Yeah, I mean, you know, working in the automotive sector, that's that level of confidentiality is something that we're familiar with. And that's important, I think, because, you know, this project in particular has been very much a collaboration with the U.S. bobsled team. And they have lifetimes of experience that they've brought to the table and really informed our process with as well. And so, you know, if those things all of a sudden were to get exposed unnecessarily, then, you know, it sort of sacrifices their incredible life's work. And that's something we take very seriously, too.
And then do you work with the drivers of the bobsleds? You know, what is your relationship with the people who are actually going to be driving these sleds like?
Yeah, absolutely. Steve Holcomb has been incredibly instrumental in the development of the sled. In particular, I would point to the steering system. The steering system is what I like to think of as sort of the central nervous system of the sled, and that really is what connects the pilot to the sled and then also to the track. And so that's the conduit through which all these feedbacks and inputs need to flow. And that's an absolutely critical, very nuanced mechanism that we placed a huge emphasis on. And Steve, you know, actually had a degenerative eye condition for much of his career. And so he developed almost the sixth sense, and he has the ability to feel things that you at first wouldn't even believe. It took me a little while to come to grips with the level of subtlety that he was able to sense. So in that sense, he was just an incredible asset as far as developing the steering system. We've also had athletes here at the studio, and we actually scan them in position in the sled so that any of our aerodynamic simulations would be truly accurate to the position or the shape and contour of the athletes, their backs, their helmets, but also the physiology, where their legs want to be, where their arms want to be, and that allowed us to kind of position the rest of the components of the sled fairly strategically.
Well, BMW Design Works is located in California. You are originally from New Hampshire. I wonder, as a former snowboarder, as somebody who has experienced winter, do you think you brought a different perspective than another designer might have?
For this project in particular, you know, my snowboard racing days certainly was the real kind of formative stage for me. Of understanding the rhythm of a course and how you approach that, or how you sacrifice certain corners so that other corners, which are more important, can be done better. Mm-hmm. And that's very much, there is a lot of crossover with bobsledding that way. And so, you know, it's a life experience that hopefully informed the project, but it's also been an incredible learning experience for me. And I really had just absolutely loved the program.
Hats off from afar to Michael Scully, New Hampshire native and creative director at BMW Design Works USA, which designed and built the two-man bobsled, which rode the U.S. team to a bronze medal at Sochi yesterday. You can take a look at his design in action and watch the wonderfully camp animation of the Jamaican bobsled song written for the Sochi course. All that is at wordofmouthradio.org. With snow hitting the region today, again, it is safe to say that cabin fever season is upon us. Up next on Word of Mouth, the VP of National Geographic Travel transports us to exotic locations around the globe and advises us on finding adventure a little closer to home. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is cabin fever season. After a solid month of snow and cold, we are all in need of an escape. Whether visiting a Caribbean destination or a cabin closer to home, traveling is an opportunity for relaxation and perhaps exploration. But how do you get off the tourism track and find the real soul of a place? National Geographic's team has compiled a list of suggestions in a new book, Where the Locals Go, more than 300 places around the world to eat, play, shop, celebrate, and relax. Keith Bellows is with us. He's editor-in-chief and senior vice president of National Geographic Traveler Magazine and Travel Media. Keith Bellows, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
Now, you were born in what is now the Democratic Republic of Congo, grew up in Canada, went to school in Scotland and the U.S., visited more than 98 countries. So let's narrow it down. What was the last place you visited, and what off-the-beaten-path thing did you do?
Well, the last interesting place I visited might be more to the point, and that would be Edinburgh.
So what did you find that captured your fancy in Edinburgh?
One of the cool things to do there, and this is something the locals can really help you with, is this is where Hogwarts came alive, and this is where Harry Potter was written. So you see all these places, and you begin to realize, oh, that's Hogwarts, or that's, you know, whatever alley it was. So I think that you know, the whole idea behind this book is to get beyond the sort of standard-bearer, iconic itineraries, you know, and try to follow your nose and try to follow the locals, see where they go.
In the introduction to the book, you write about the great pleasures of the happy accident. So what would you consider a happy accident?
I think a happy accident is when you go into a Dublin pub and there's four or five, you know, local musicians hanging around and they're just playing all night and it's drinking copious amounts of beer and, you know, it gets to be 2 o'clock in the morning and the pub's closing and, you know, you're starving, and so you sit down at the table with, you know, these musicians are beginning to pack up, and you ask them, is there a really good place to eat that, you know, at this time of night, and that isn't, you know, isn't pub food, but is, you know, the sort of favorite haunt of the people who live here, and, you know, sure enough, that's where they're headed.
Hmm. Give us an example of a time when travel plans have gone awry and wound up being a positive experience for you.
when I went to India for the first time, and I ended up driving from Jaipur to Agra. Unfortunately, the day, this is when the Indians in a small village, who had been out of without electricity for a week, just got fed up, and they shut down the road. And the massed crowds wouldn't let us through. And I was with Paul Theroux and a couple of other people, and he spoke a little bit of Hindi, and this looked really bad. It looked like we were going to be spending the night in the middle of nowhere. And we went up, and he spoke to this cab driver on the other side of the barricade, and we literally picked up this tiny little cab. There were 13 of us, turned it around. It wasn't actually a cab, it was a Jeep, and climbed in. You know, we left our luggage, and we ended up going, you know, another probably 50 miles with camels on both sides of the road and, you know, elephants. And we ended up getting to the hotel where they dressed us in what looked like Ku Klux Klan garb because we were going to go have dinner with somebody, and we had no clothes. We were caked in mud. And it was one of the most delightful things that's ever happened to me, because you kind of see the underbelly of travel, but in the final essence, you saw the locals, and they were fixing their cars or, you know, working on the engines of their lorries or whatever. And it's interesting to see how a culture will take a happy accident and turn it into a wonderful afternoon in the sun. And I think so many people, especially Americans, and I remember some people on the bus were going, "Oh my God, we're going to miss our spa appointment." But the actual event was much more enjoyable than any spa treatment.
Nice way to name check Paul Theroux as your travel companion, by the way.
Oh, well, he's great. Yeah, he knows how to travel.
Well, he's a seasoned traveler. You're a seasoned traveler. How about for the layperson? How do we make room for those happy accidents?
I think you just have to be willing to be surprised and be willing to make the effort to reach out, go into a coffee, you know, shop or a bar, and pick out the sort of coolest person in the place, and just try to strike up a conversation. Find out where do they eat breakfast in the morning, and, you know, what's their favorite music spot at night, and is there a great place to get jazz here, or where do I go where the tourists don't know? And you'd be just surprised. People, when they're approached that way, really respond. They really love to share their own backyard.
We're talking to Keith Bellows. He's editor-in-chief and senior vice president of National Geographic Traveler magazine, an inveterate traveler with many, many different experiences. His team has helped compile this book called Where the Locals Go. So how about balancing that spontaneity with seeing the main attractions? I mean, if somebody does go to Rome, for example, you know, they want to see the Colosseum. They want to see St. Peter's Cathedral. They want to stick their hand in the mouth of truth. How do you balance that with the local experience?
Well, first of all, you'd be crazy not to see those places. But I think the thing to try to avoid is getting back to your hotel and asking the concierge where's a great place to have, you know, dinner, because he's going to tell you, he's got his big black book, he's going to open it up, he's going to go down and pick the place the tourists go. And so you don't need to do that.
It can be difficult for people to travel far from home, to affordability time. How about finding adventure closer to home? Any suggestions there?
Oh, well, there's adventures everywhere close to home. I mean, it's the thing is, any city, any of our cities, and I would include, you know, Washington, where I live, if you're willing to, you know, make the effort, you're going to constantly discover places in your own hometown that you didn't know existed.
Yeah, you've got stuff on Las Vegas, off the Strip, Memphis, Gainesville, Florida, tailgating with the University of Florida, Boston, some tips on clam chowder,
yep.
And New Orleans, moving beyond Bourbon Street. Any locals tell you, yep, you got that absolutely right?
Yep. I just talked to somebody from Texas. They were talking about the cowboy boots in Austin, and, you know, she said, "But you really nailed it. And, you know, the best place to get, you know, brisket, there it is. That's what we know that."
Now, Keith Bellows, I know you went to Dartmouth.
Mm-hmm.
Any ideas about finding adventure in our own states and towns, the places that we think we know so well?
Well, you know, Dartmouth, I mean, New Hampshire was incredible outdoor wonderland. And I mean, it's you know, that's a flip side of localism, where you're looking for the wonderful stretch of water on the Connecticut to kayak, or you're looking for the place to go, you know, you're trying to experience the outdoors far away from other people.
Well, Keith Bellows, thank you for getting us in the adventurous spirit. We needed it today.
Thank you. I enjoyed this.
Keith Bellows, editor-in-chief and senior VP of National Geographic Traveler magazine and Travel Media. This team put together Where the Locals Go. It's a list of places around the world to play and shop and celebrate and relax. And of course, because it's Nat Geo, the photographs are terrific. And we would love to hear from you. How about your happy accidents and your unhappy ones? Tourists do flock to New Hampshire to ski and hike and leaf peep. Which off the beaten path would you suggest? You can join the conversation going on our Facebook page, facebook.com/word of mouth. We're going to stay on the travel beat with a story from the mountains of mid-Africa. We'll hear the story of a woman who traveled from Oklahoma to Rwanda to visit the site where Diane Fossey studied gorillas in their natural habitat. Although this woman was not quite as savvy as her predecessor, a lesson in what not to do when photographing gorillas, coming up on Word of Mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Had just about enough of the snow? Well, now you can close your eyes and let us transport you somewhere far, far away to the rolling green hills and misty mountains of mid-Africa. Sounds lush, maybe a little peaceful, right? Well, this land radio brings us a story of a safari gone wrong.
If you marry me, I will buy you a computer and take you to see the world.
That's how Jerry proposed to Janice.
I'm on, I think, my 7th or 8th computer now.
And they've been traveling the world ever since. Their first expedition was to a mountain in Rwanda to see gorillas.
Diane Fossey's gorillas, because we both love gorillas. That's the noise they told us to make.
It was a pretty ambitious trek. Janice was 53 years old, and
I was kind of overweight, to put it nicely.
And on the other side of the mountain, war was raging in the Congo.
So we got in the back of these pickup trucks with all these gorillas, and I mean not gorilla animals, but gorillas, these guys with machine guns and bullets strapped across their shoulders. There was, I would say, probably one guard for each one of us that went on the climb.
Because of the violence, Jerry and Janice were given a visa for one day only. They had from sunrise to sunset to find what they had come all the way from Oklahoma looking for. Here's Janice reading from her book, My Finest.
As we gathered to begin the ascent, the tracker asked if any of us needed a porter, and he looked directly at me, the overweight 53-year-old American woman. Yes, I said, thinking it would be nice to have someone carry my backpack for me. One or two, he asked me. Okay, two, I agreed, thinking Jerry would probably like someone to carry his stuff too. Little did I know that Thomas and Greg would be carrying me and not my backpack up that mountainside. We started up the path, a long line of us, two trekkers in the front, three or four military guards behind them, three more trekkers, a couple more guards, Jerry, me, and my porters, more guards, another tracker behind us. It was an hour's hike just to the top of the farming tiers. This was not a hill, but a 65-degree slope. By the look on their faces, I knew Thomas and Greg realized their work was cut out for them. Finally, we made it to the Parc du Volcan. That's where the real trekking began. The jungle was dense. Just touching or brushing a nettle would set my fingers on fire. Up, 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 more and more. The tracker was hacking his way through the jungle with his machete. The ground underneath us was peat moss, sometimes slippery mud. My thighs were so weak I could barely lift them the 18 inches to another foothold, indentations in the mud or a rock. When the steps were too steep or too slippery, Greg and Thomas would put their arms underneath my armpits and hoist me up. After another hour's torture, we made it to where Sousa's group had nested the night before. Now, Sousa was the last baby born before Diane Fossey died. He was her little favorite. The smell was overpowering, a wild, musky scent. It was a big area with lots of giant nests fashioned from leaves. Up, 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 more and more. The trail was too narrow now for Greg and Thomas to lift me up, so one stood above me and dragged me up while one shoved me from behind. I started feeling faint, dizzy, queasy, queasier. Once when I was about to break into tears, Thomas tapped my arm and pointed up the mountain. There, way above me on a ledge, no bigger than an inch from my point of view, a giant silverback screamed at us, smashing a tree limb over and over onto the ground. The inside of his mouth was a spot of red in a mountain of green. We kept climbing. The tracker, 30 yards ahead of us, pointed to a thicket. They're here. All around us, gorillas ate, belched, mumbled to each other, farted. Behind me, a mother and her youngster were quietly eating. We crawled a bit to the left, and there lying in the leaves, we saw a giant silverback chewing on sticks. The tracker nudged me. I turned to my right, and he pulled the foliage back like a curtain. Not more than 6 feet from me sat a giant blackback. I grabbed my camera to snap a shot. The sound of the zoom made the blackback turn and stare at me. The camera flashed. I gasped. The tracker gasped. The women beside me gasped. The gorilla slapped his eyes. I hunkered down, trying to be small. "Don't move," the tracker warned. The blackback leapt straight up and stood directly over me, then charged behind me and crashed through the trees, disappearing into the jungle. The trip down was pretty wild. At some points, I basically just started rolling. At the bottom, I reached into my money belt and gave Thomas and Greg $15 each, which was like a month's salary for them. And then I hugged them, even though they were embarrassed. Why should they be embarrassed? There were only a few parts of my body they hadn't both touched that unforgettable day. I almost died that day.
And our thanks for that story, which was a This Land Press production. Last week, I spoke with Justice Sonia Sotomayor for Writers on a New England Stage. Along with her remarkable life story, she revealed some pretty interesting things.
I haven't given up hope I'll meet somebody. I understand it's a little intimidating.
Well, we think Justice Sotomayor would be a great catch, so we created a dating profile for her. Her interests include...
I go to the gym. I play poker. One of the Saturday morning things I've been doing is exploring D.C., Virginia, and Maryland by biking. I think that there's nothing more exciting in the world than to be curious about the world.
Although she does admit she can be a little judgy at times. You can check out Justice Sotomayor's dating profile at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you know anyone in the market, share it with a friend. After all, some great love matches have been ignited by word of mouth. I haven't got anything but love, young woman, 8 days a week. 50 years after the Beatles made contact in the U.S., we're going to check out their lyrics with the blogger Grammar Girl. That's when Word of Mouth returns, after the headlines from NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. 50 years ago this month, the Beatles first arrived in the United States, and we are still singing their songs. She's got a ticket to ride. She's got a ticket to ride. She's got a ticket to ride, and she don't care. Catchy? Yes. Grammatically correct? No. Sadly, even the four lads from Liverpool cannot escape the discerning ear of Grammar Girl. Joining me now to dig into poetic license and the lyrics of the Beatles is Mignon Fogarty, creator of Grammar Girl and founder of Quick and Dirty Tips. Great to have you with us again.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so she's got a ticket to ride, but she don't care. Say that grammatically correctly for us, please.
She has a ticket to ride, but she doesn't care. It doesn't have quite the same rhythm.
It's a little prim. It's not real rock and roll. What are some of the other grammar faux pas of the Beatles, and how would you correct the errors?
Well, they like the word ain't, so ain't got nothing but love, babe. They have the song Ain't She Sweet. I mean, a lot of rock and roll and music likes ain't and informal words like that. And then there's the one Live and Let Die. That's Paul McCartney by himself, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yes, I believe so.
Right. But there's always been this almost a controversy about this line where he talks about the ever-changing world in which we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And that
yes.
that in on the end is unnecessary. Ending a sentence with a preposition isn't always wrong, but when the preposition is unnecessary, you should leave it off. So he could have said ever-changing world in which we live. When I listened to the song, I always thought he was saying the world in which we're living, and that would have been grammatically correct. So that brings up a problem, or at least a thing about music, is that we can't always even tell what they're saying.
But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say live and let die.
But the origins of rock and roll is rhythm and blues, which came from rural music and blues, African-American jump blues especially, and lingo. So the language of the music that hooked the Beatles in is that very kind of language. Do artists like the Beatles get a pass, Mignon?
Oh, of course. It would be ridiculous to hold musicians to perfect grammar. It's an art form, just like poetry or literature, fiction. You know, we don't hate E.E. Cummings because he uses all lowercase letters. We don't refuse to read Cormac McCarthy because he doesn't use commas when he should. As a society, we do grant our artists poetic license, and you know, musicians are artists too. It's frustrating for teachers because when students are singing along with songs that are grammatically incorrect, Lady Gaga's song, Bad Romance, you know, it's I Want Your Love and I Want Your Revenge. You and me could write a bad romance. It should be you and I. And when students are singing along with something that's incorrect, music is a great tool for reinforcing memory. So it's sort of burning it into their minds the wrong way, which is frustrating when you're trying to teach the rules, but that's just the way it is.
Boy, this one would drive my father crazy, who made us say you and I over and over and over again. Here's Lady Gaga. It does take some talent to use even grammatically incorrect phrases well, but do we also have to draw the line somewhere there? I mean, if you're just doing it badly, and any examples that you can think of?
Well, it frustrates me as a listener when you get the impression the musician doesn't know, that they're not doing it intentionally to hit a beat or make a rhyme, but they're just doing it because they don't know. So, for example, you know, Justin Bieber's If I was your boyfriend, it should be if I were your boyfriend. And it wouldn't change the rhythm, and it wouldn't change the meaning. It's just the wrong word.
If I was your boyfriend,
That I find more frustrating than something like ain't or something that is more of a slang word or...
Like drank? We get a lot of drank.
You know, I wrote an article about how that song was wrong and I got called to the carpet because there's a rap song, Buy You a Drank.
Buy you a drink.
Drank is an actual drink that people can buy. That's the name of a drink. And apparently it's the name of a drink and drug concoction that's popular in the rap world. Like, I just got called out that I am culturally illiterate when it comes to the rap world. And I had misunderstood the whole point of the song. So, you know, I mean, and that's a real lesson that songs speak to specific audiences and that their cultural experience and language expectations are different, most likely from yours and mine.
Well, we just proved that, I think. And how do the Beatles compare to more current pop artists? Are we hearing more or fewer grammatical errors nowadays?
Well, I think it's common to believe that kids today are worse than kids were 50 years ago. You know, adults like to think of the good old days. And, you know, I haven't done a systematic comparison of old songs versus new songs, but I suspect we would find a similar number of what people might consider errors.
For someone who has such a discerning grammatical ear, it could really significantly narrow one's options for a playlist if irked by incorrect grammar. I wonder if you find yourself cringing at grammar faux pas in your daily life.
I don't. I mean, not in music, especially. You know, with that Lady Gaga song, I loved it, and I didn't even realize it was grammatically incorrect until maybe the third time I'd heard it. I don't pay attention to a lot of things like that when I'm listening to music. Certain things do jump out, like the if I was versus if I were. I think also it depends a lot on how clear the lyrics are. If it's a slow song where the artist is enunciating every word and you can really follow along with every word, it will bother me more than if it's a rap song where they're going so fast I'm not even sure what they're saying. I find often I don't catch every word in a song, and whether it's slurred or it's fast. And so it doesn't really bother me.
Careful what we sing along with, I guess. Mignon, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Mignon Fogarty is founder of Quick and Dirty Tips and also the creator of Grammar Girl and Grammar Girl's Peeve Wars. That's a card game. You can find it on fundanything.com that lets you play with grammar pet peeves. Competitive yoga sounds like an oxymoron along the lines of jumbo shrimp or virtual reality, but it is a real thing and it is intensely competitive. So how does one train to be aggressive in a practice that is typically meant to encourage relaxation and discourage judgment for one's own limits or progress? NHBR's Emily Corwin brings us a story of a Seacoast yoga practitioner heading to the national championships.
Emily Avery is ambitious. She's a first-year student at Princeton, a pre-professional ballerina, and she wants to be a neurosurgeon. Avery is also very flexible.
You bend your elbows down below your calf muscle and tuck your chin into your chest and put your forehead onto your knee. So that.
Avery contorts her body into standing head to knee. It's one of seven postures she and about 200 other competitors will perform before a panel of judges at the upcoming National Yoga Championships. Last year, Avery won first place in the youth division. This year, she'll compete as an adult.
It's based on alignment and grace and
no reversal of movement or shaking. Avery's been practicing yoga for 4 years at a Bikram studio in Portsmouth, but she doesn't have a studio nearby at Princeton. So as she prepares for her big competition, Avery relies on her coach, Sarah Curry, back home.
And I also film myself doing my routine wherever, like at a random studio or in my room or something, and then I'll send it to her, and then she'll email me back with corrections.
LA-based USA Yoga started the championships in 2003. Board member and judge Cynthia Ware says it's about celebrating yoga and bringing more people into the practice.
We want to take what already exists and bring it more to the masses.
But the idea of competitive yoga doesn't sit well with everyone. Ware says it perplexes people. It seems counterintuitive.
How can it be? That's so un-yogic. That just never exists. And it's like, no, you know.
So how flexible is the definition of the word yoga? It depends what kind of yoga studio you're standing in.
Abdominal wall, compression abdominal cavity, created through contraction until ribcage visible front mirror. Exhale,
the origins of competitive yoga in America start here, in a 105-degree yoga studio.
And then it's elbows touch. Inhale again, stomach.
Most competitors, like Emily Avery, study Bikram yoga. USA Yoga is trying to recruit competitors in other styles. But selling the idea of competitive yoga to non-Bikram teachers can prove difficult.
Skeletal body to sit up tall.
Dina Alessio teaches Ashtanga Vinyasa Yoga in Portsmouth. She says she has nothing against competitive yoga. It's just not what her classes are about.
We have something called drishti, which is like your gaze, and you should keep it soft so you're not comparing to the person next to you. And you're not even supposed to be comparing to what it was for you yesterday. Like, you don't want to be judging yourself every time you get on the mat either.
Alessio says breath and energy are the fundamentals of the yoga tradition, and she's not sure how they could figure into a competition. But USA Yoga's Cynthia Ware says competitive yoga is based on the yoga tradition. It's possible, she says, to judge breath and energy by observing competitors' bodies and eyes. And she says it's not like yoga competitions are some kind of American construct.
And this is something that is actually already exists in India.
University of Pittsburgh anthropologist Joseph Alter says yes. Yoga competitions began popping up in India in the 1930s and got popular in the 1950s. But that was after about 2,000 years of non-competitive practice. Alter says Indians also disagree about whether or not traditional yoga can be competitive. As far as he's concerned, though, judging and choosing a champion severs the sport from its traditional past.
The fundamental ideas that underlie yoga in practice are antithetical to competition.
Alter has never been to a yoga competition, although he says he finds the prospect fascinating. And 19-year-old competitor Emily Avery says when you get there, you realize it's not like other sports.
The competitors are not cutthroat like... Yeah, it's more about demonstrating what you can do with your body right now.
But Avery says she is a little nervous.
I definitely want to do well, and yeah, I don't want to let myself down, I guess.
Avery will compete at the national competition on March 14th in San Antonio. For Word of Mouth, I'm Emily Corwin.
Thank you so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is so much more to hear and to see on our website, including a delightful conversation with Justice Sonia Sotomayor when she revealed that she loves bike riding, is a poker enthusiast, and is open to meeting somebody special. We found her to be a terrific date and think she's quite the catch. So we created a dating profile and a video for her. You can watch the video and listen to the full interview at Word of Mouth Radio.org and spread it around. Who knows where it could go? You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio and online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org. Word
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.